When I was asked to do this talk, I immediately thought Shirakane and Tetsuyasu. And you may say, well, what's this got to do with mushrooms and chicken on a stick? You know, why do you want to talk to us about Japanese cuisine? But that's not what I mean here. The Shirakane were the broads, and the Tetsuyasu were the narrows in a split in the Bulgarian social democratic movement in 1903. Now, at that stage, Bulgaria was overwhelmingly agrarian, tiny working class, economically extremely backward, dominated by a small elite. Now, at this stage, you probably say, well, why don't you tell us about Japanese cuisine, Rick? But actually, that split in March 1903 was a split about the kind of party that was going to be necessary to lead the movement forward to bring about social change in Bulgaria and eventually socialism in Bulgaria. Now, there's another split that happened a little bit later in that year, in 1903, in August, and you probably do know the names of the groups that were formed out of that split. It was the Mensheviks, who were the equivalent of the Shirakane, and the Bolsheviks, who were the equivalent of the Bulgarian Tetsuyasu. And that split, too, was largely about the kind of party that was necessary to take the workers' movement forward in Russia. And in both cases, both the Bulgarian case, where the working class was not only a very small section of society, but also small in absolute terms, and also in Russia, where the working class is proportionately a small section of society, but numerically more significant, the issue was what sorts of politics would a social democratic, and at that stage social democratic meant Marxist, organisation have? What sort of politics should it have? And also, internally, how should it be organised? Should it be organised so that anybody who was vaguely sympathetic could join? Or should it be organised on a more disciplined basis, where people who were considered to be members were not just sympathisers, but people who acted politically under the direction of the party? Now, in both of these cases, they thought that they were acting in the tradition of the social democratic movement going back a very long way. They didn't see themselves as making a break with what was going on, for example, in Germany, which had by far the largest social democratic movement in the world at that stage, by far the largest socialist party in the world at that stage. They didn't see that there was a break going on. What they thought that they were doing was preventing non-working class elements having undue influence inside the Workers' Party. And in both cases, they were concerned about intellectuals who might associate with the party but not work under its discipline in shaping the direction that the party took. And in the Bulgarian case, they were also concerned about significant numbers of self-employed artisans and peasants joining the party and diluting its politics. And they wanted their parties to be proletarian. But by virtue of their conception of how they would deal with these problems, they developed what became, in the words of the Communist International after the First World War, a party of a new type, a different kind of a party that was distinct from the old tradition of social democratic organisation. That tradition saw itself as growing out of the work of Marx and Engels, and in a real sense, this was true. Marx and Engels were not just a pair of old buffers with beards who sat around and wrote stuff. They actually organised. And they organised inside the German working class in the lead-up to the 1848 revolution and during that revolution, and they subsequently organised at an international level through the International Working Men's Association in the 1860s and the 1870s. In both cases, their work emphasised the importance of political clarity, being clear about what the problems that faced the workers' movement was, and organising people to join organisations on the basis of confronting those problems and proposing solutions, an organisation proposing solutions that were really what the bottom line of Marxism is, which is it's all about working class self-emancipation. It's about the working class taking control of society through its own efforts. Now, as the parties of the Second International grew from the end of the 1880s through the 1890s, and particularly in Germany, very large numbers of workers flocked to the German Social Democratic Party. It became an organisation of tens and then even hundreds of thousands of members. They saw themselves acting in a Marxist tradition, but there wasn't the same emphasis on the importance of political clarity as Marx and Engels had placed in their own organising efforts. And this was already apparent in the 1870s when Marx wrote a document that was highly critical of the basis on which two different small socialist groups came together to form one socialist party in Germany. This was at a conference that took place at a town called Gotha in Germany, and the combined parties put out a program called the Gotha Program, and Marx wrote some marginal notes that was very critical about the lack of clarity in the Gotha Program. The German Social Democratic Party's leadership, or the mainstream of the leadership, saw itself as a party of the entire working class, trying to embrace the entire working class across a spectrum of different ideas. And while the leadership was in a formal sense Marxist, not all party members were Marxists, and in fact not all members of the leadership itself were actually Marxists. Sections of the leadership in southern Germany, where political circumstances were more tolerant and where there was a much greater inclination to engage in parliamentary work and less emphasis on revolutionary politics, people like David were not Marxists. This lack of clarity and its consequences became very apparent with the outbreak of the First World War, when the leadership of German social democracy capitulated to German nationalism and in practice supported the war effort. And that lesson of the collapse of German social democracy into chauvinism, into nationalism, and in fact the collapse of the broader social democratic movement into nationalism, support for their own ruling classes' war efforts, led to a split in the movement and the formation of communist parties in the period from 1918 onwards. And the model that the communist parties adopted was the Bolsheviks. And the experience of the Bolsheviks in organising a party which they thought was pretty orthodox, but which in practice adopted some different approaches to its internal organisation, that became a model for the communist parties subsequently. Because communists came to recognise that if you're going to have a revolution, and I'm not going to go into why a revolution is necessary, if you're going to have a revolution, then you need an organisation that is designed to carry a revolution through. You need, in other words, a revolutionary party. Taking power in workplaces and smashing the capitalist state, which is really what the guts of a revolution is not an easy task. Even though the working class is a majority of the population, certainly these days in much of the world, and you know, two-thirds of the Australian population is working class, most of the time, most workers are not revolutionary. The power of the capitalist class inside our heads means that working class consciousness, working class ideas about the nature of the society that they are in and what their interests are and how to take their interests forward are extremely uneven. So you have some people who are revolutionary Marxists, and you know, it's a bit of a shock today that not many of those people in Australia at present. And on the other hand, you have people thoroughly working class in terms of their jobs and in terms of their, you know, personal histories, who think that the editorial line of the Daily Telegraph or the Herald Sun is, you know, absolutely the way to go. Very uneven consciousness in the working class. The power of the capitalist class, the extent to which people are influenced by ruling ideas or the extent to which those dominant ideas are undermined by the experience of struggle and engagement with revolutionary politics, in other words, varies a great deal. In order to deal with that unevenness of consciousness in the working class, in order to deal with the concentrated power of the capitalist state, which is ultimately an armed power that can repress challenges to it. And if you want more details about the nature of the capitalist state in Australia, you can read my chapter in this book. It's edited. Diane has a vested interest in, which she didn't mention. She's a contributor to this as well. In order to deal with that uneven consciousness, in order to deal with the power of the capitalist state, ultimately armed power, and of course the power of the bosses in every workplace. Now, we might think that Australia is a democracy, but the first thing to recognise is that every workplace is a dictatorship, and then we can begin to take apart the idea that we have much of a say, even through the ballot box and parliament. In order to deal with the power of the capitalist class in these ways, it's necessary to have a revolutionary organisation, to have a centralised, democratic working class organisation whose focus is revolutionary politics. It has to be organised around revolutionary politics because its task is to smash the capitalist state. People who are involved in it have to know that what they're up against is this incredible power, and what they are trying to do is build an organisation and a broader movement around it that is capable of taking on this power. It has to be centralised because the capitalist state itself is centralised and uses that centralisation to deploy its very considerable resources to destroy its opponents. And if we're going to deal with the power of the capitalist state, we need to deploy the resources of our side in a consistent and a coherent kind of a way. It has to be democratic because that's the only way in which a revolutionary organisation can keep in touch with the wider working class, the only way in which a revolutionary organisation can effectively learn from the experience of the large numbers of militants who make up its membership or who look to the party for leadership. If it's to have any chance of success, such a revolutionary organisation has to be large, capable of responding to changes in circumstances and to win the majority of the working class to its politics. This kind of party, therefore, does not seek to recruit all workers, or indeed people beyond the working class too, who believe that there are problems with the way things are. Now, there are, I would say, a majority of the working class at the moment think that there are real problems with Australian society. Are we looking to recruit them as they are today? And the answer is, no, we're not. Because given the tasks of a revolutionary organisation, a revolutionary party, it's made up of people who have revolutionary working class politics, who are prepared to be active together, to be active under their combined discipline, under the leadership of a revolutionary party, or who are at least moving in that direction, who are exploring the ideas of revolutionary politics and can better explore them from inside a revolutionary organisation than outside it. In that sense, and we get back to Bulgaria here, we're talking about a narrow party rather than the broad one. A party that seeks to organise what Lenin called the vanguard of the working class rather than the working class itself. Vanguard of the working class in a literal sense of what vanguard means. The vanguard is the front elements of the army on the move. It's not a body outside the army, it's a part of the army but right at the cutting edge. And that's who a revolutionary Marxist party seeks to organise rather than the entire army, that is, the entirety of the working class. Now, building such a party is bloody hard. We know that. We want such a party in Australia. We see our activities as directed towards building that kind of a party in Australia, but it certainly doesn't exist now, a mass organisation with these kinds of characteristics. It's a very hard slog. Building broad parties is a lot easier. Even building large, broad parties is a lot easier. It doesn't swim against the current of dominant ideas in society to nearly the same extent. A broad working class party may represent a mobilisation of workers and be positive in that sense, but it's a mobilisation of workers that basically accepts the framework of capitalism rather than challenging the existence of capitalism itself and posing a revolutionary alternative. A broad party may encompass people who do have revolutionary politics on one wing or in one or several factions, but it also encompasses and embraces other sections who don't have revolutionary politics, who think that change can come through Parliament, that it's possible to skin capitalism, the capitalist tiger, claw by claw, rather than clubbing the bugger over the head in one fell swoop. Now, there have been a number of recent experiments along the lines of building broad parties which have had a certain degree of success. And revolutionaries have been involved in a number of these projects and have seen these projects as taking the class struggle forward and possibly even constituting a challenge to capitalism. One of them that you've probably heard of is the Partido dos Trabalhadores in Brazil, the Workers' Party in Brazil, which was formed out of an incredible upsurge in industrial action in the early 1980s. This was working class trade union action against the boss. And not only was it militant working class action against the boss, it was under a military dictatorship as well. Very, very militant indeed, involved the mobilisation of very large numbers of workers. And it was an organisation that had a base inside the working class and continued to support working class industrial mobilisation as well as engaging in parliamentary political activity. Eventually, a trade union militant who had been involved in the foundation of that party, a guy who is known as Lula, was elected to be president of Brazil in 2002. And then he was re-elected as president again last year. Now, the story of Lula in power is a farcical and tragical story, because in power, Lula has in practice implemented neoliberal policies. He's continued a series of policies that were begun under his predecessor, who had also been a leftist at one stage, quite a famous left-wing sociologist. Lula continued those kinds of policies, remained in the good books of the IMF and the World Bank, and cut himself off from the real basis of support of the organisation, that is the working class. And on top of that, the Workers' Party became involved in all sorts of corruption scandals, bribery scandals, involving very senior officials of the party and also senior parliamentarians and members of Lula's own staff as well. And right from the beginning, there had been revolutionaries involved in the formation of the Workers' Party in Brazil. And there were huge aspirations, huge hopes in what the Workers' Party could achieve. It seemed as though the Workers' Party represented a dramatic break from the old politics of Brazil. It certainly represented a break from the mainstream parties and the dictatorship. But in a fundamental sense, it didn't represent a break from political traditions in Brazil or internationally, because really what the Workers' Party turned into was a social democratic organisation. A broad party, in a lot of ways like the Social Democratic Party in Germany before the First World War, that organised very large numbers of workers, including many, many militant workers and some revolutionaries, but also organised people who thought that the prime project was not to destroy capitalism, but to capture political power, and especially the presidency of Brazil, in order, they would argue, to make things nicer for the working class. Another example, and this was an example of a broad party being built from really the bottom up, from scratch. Another example is that of the Partito della Rifondazione Comunista in Italy, Communist Refoundation in Italy, which was founded as a split from the old Italian Communist Party, which was a reformist, Stalinist organisation demoralised by the collapse of Stalinism in Eastern Europe. In 1991, there's a split to found Refondazione, which includes hardline Stalinists, but also includes people who want to revise the whole tradition of the Italian Communist Party. And into that split organisation comes a group from the radical left as well. So there's a bit of a regroupment involved there. But in Rifondazione, there was no really thoroughgoing settling of accounts with the history of the old PCI, and in particular, not with the way in which the PCI had supported Christian democratic governments between 1976 and 1979, a period which saw the stabilisation, the re-stabilisation of Italian capitalism after a period of very high levels of class struggle that began at the end of the 1990s. You had a Christian democratic dominated government, the communists outside the government but in parliament being part of the majority of the Christian Democrats. That was a disastrous political experience. The Refondazione in the mid-1990s offered support for the first of the governments of Romano Prodi, who is again the Prime Minister of Italy, a centre-left kind of a government. It offered support from outside the government and critical support, and eventually in 1998 withdrew that support, which dramatically destabilised Prodi's government and undermined its majority in the parliament. So that was quite promising, to pull away support from the Prodi government, a centre-left government which is introducing neoliberal policies. What's more, from 2001, Rifondazione involved itself in the demonstrations against the G8 meeting in Genoa, and then subsequently it involved itself in the Florence Social Forums. It made a real opening to the movement against capitalist globalisation and gained a large amount of credibility on the significant elements of the far left in Italy to the left of Rifondazione itself. Rifondazione also mobilised for anti-war protests and huge demonstrations against the Berlusconi government's neoliberal policies. But now, Rifondazione is a part of the Italian government of Romano Prodi, the second Prodi government. Bertinotti, one of the former secretary of Rifondazione, is in the cabinet. I think he's the speaker of the lower house of Parliament, and Rifondazione has been part of a government that has sent Italian troops as part of the UN peacekeeping force in southern Lebanon, and also has sent troops to Afghanistan, a government which has been involved in the construction of a huge US base in Vicenza in the face of demonstrations against this Vicenza base of 200,000 people. This was justified on the basis of it was necessary to prevent Berlusconi winning the last election in 2006 and to prevent him getting back into office. Rifondazione is another example of a broad party. A broad party formed as a split to the left from a reformist form of Stalinism, a party which had a number of different currents inside it, the dominant one of the leadership of the party, which went back to the old PCI, but other revolutionary currents inside it. And it's ended not very happily, and with the emergence of a split that is still in process by the main left-wing faction, which is called the Critica The critical left. The critical left. There's another development in Germany, where in 2004 there was a new organisation, the Electoral Alternative for Social Justice, set up in 2004 by dissident members of the Social Democratic Party and dissident trade union officials, that was designed to set up a genuine left alternative to social democracy in the Greens, who had been in government together for some years and implemented a series of neoliberal policies, had sent German troops overseas to Afghanistan and also earlier on to Somalia. The idea was to build a left social democratic Keynesian kind of an organisation. In the 2005 elections, the WASG, as it's called in Germany by its initials, went into an alliance with the old East German Communist Party, and together they won 9% of the vote and 54 seats in the lower German House of Parliament. But the old East German Communist Party is actually in government in the city-state of Berlin in a what's called a red-red coalition with the Social Democrats, and is privatising public assets and sacking public servants. The WASG is in the process of fusing with the ex-Communist Party, the PDS in Germany. Now, we don't have a revolutionary party. The big question is how we get one. And one answer is that we can do that by transforming a broad electoral party into a revolutionary organisation. And this is an argument that was made by a leader of the Scottish Socialist Party, a guy called Murray Smith, who's now in the same organisation that John Mullen belongs to, although not in the same tendency of the Revolutionary Communist League in France. And basically he argues that there is no space for reformism anymore. Reformism as a project is finished, so any socialist party will inevitably evolve in the direction of revolutionary politics. Now, what this is a recipe for, in practice, is a recipe for the reconstruction of social democracy, because social democracy is never finished. Social democracy does not depend on the ability of capitalism to offer reforms. If it can offer reforms, social democracy is a lot more credible. Social democracy depends on workers' hopes that there are shortcuts for overcoming the problems of capitalism. Shortcuts that don't take the long and hard route of building a narrow, large party, but go through parliamentary institutions. So what it represents is a mobilisation against aspects of capitalism, but not a recognition of what is necessary to overcome capitalism. So that kind of an approach is one that's been tried. New reformist parties have been founded in the period since the scope for reforms has become dramatically narrowed, and workers have looked to those parties with a great deal of hope. And in some respects, the organisation of those parties, the political mobilisation, has been a positive step, but those parties themselves have not evolved in a revolutionary direction. In the examples that we've looked at, they've either been founded on a reformist basis or they've evolved in that direction. Now, there are other approaches to building a narrow party, hopefully a very large narrow party, a narrow party that will eventually lead a majority of the working class. And it's not possible, I think, to say that there are eternally correct means of building a revolutionary socialist party, that there are tactics that are true for all time. For example, the construction of the electoral alternative in Germany represented a break from social democracy, significant numbers of workers mobilising around politics that were critical of neoliberalism. Should revolutionaries not have been involved in that? Should they have stood back and said, no, no, you represent a tactic of reconstructing social democracy, building a broad party, we stand for a narrow party? Now, that I think would be a mistake. So it's not a question of you never get tainted by touching reformists, not that I think Diane's a reformist. The question is, what are you trying to achieve out of your short-term tactics? Are you trying to achieve the construction of a large broad party which will somehow, and in an abstract way, lead to in a revolutionary direction, or are you involved in working class mobilisations which may take the form of building new social democratic organisations precisely to build a revolutionary current that is capable of acting independently in the not too distant future? There are no rules for how to do this. Another tactic that has been adopted internationally is to try and build what looks very much like a broad part, a narrow party trying to build, or a large propaganda group trying to build a broad party on the basis of its own organisation in order to work inside it. Now, that tactic, which has been labelled a united front of a special kind, I'm not sure about. But that may not be a wrong tactic. The fundamental thing, though, is political clarity about where we are going politically, what kind of an organisation we want to build. We want to build a revolutionary party, a clear, narrow party, and in trying to achieve that, all sorts of very concrete judgments have to be made about the situation that we find ourselves in. In Australia, there's no doubt about it. The idea of entering a Labor Party in order to find workers who are moving to the left, no, this is a bizarre notion. The idea of entering the Greens in order to find a constituency that is orienting in the left direction and that is open to revolutionary politics also makes no sense at all. I think that things are straightforward here. The road to a revolutionary party, a narrow party in Australia, is a road that involves being very clear about what is necessary and trying to build a revolutionary organisation out in the open. Now, that may not always be the case, but I think it's very clearly the case now. The situation in other countries is much more, well, at least in some other countries, is much more complicated and is a matter that is open to considerable debate.